like a stone, like a hill, like home. Still, what I find is you are always on my mind. Could I feel happy for you when I hear you talk with her like we used to? Could I set everything free when I watch you holding her the way you once held me? Change like the sky, like the leaves, like a butterfly. Death like a door to a place we've never been before. Would you live forever, never die, while everything around passes? Would you smile forever, never cry?
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 11 a.m. Next up is the bike show.
Hello, and welcome to the KBOO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live on kboo.fm. My name is Alon Robb, and I will be joined today by co-host Nedra Deadweiler. Our engineer, as always, is Ty Walker. And a big thank you to you, our listeners, for joining us today. We are happy to be carried by fellow community stations across the land, including Radio Tacoma and KRC Radio of Corvallis, Oregon, where our show is aired every other Sunday at noon. The station, streaming at krcfm.com, is, in its own words, freeform local radio dedicated to playing great music and building community. We have another good show lined up today with inspiring guests. In the first half, our guest is Sarah Swallow, who is one of the creators of the Golden Gravel Trail, a brand new 3,700-mile gravel route from the Oregon coast to the Mississippi River. Sarah is a trailblazer in adventure cycling and is, in her own words, driven by curiosity, resilience, and a passion for exploration. In the second half of the show, Nedra will speak with Sarah Dubé-Rito, a community builder and artist who is a transportation and mobility coordinator for the city of Evanston, Illinois. Before we get to our guest and to some news items, a warm welcome to co-host Nedra Deadweiler. Are you with us, Nedra?
Okay.
Nedra, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. How are you?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay, good. I'm doing great today.
Great. How are you keeping yourself strong? How are you keeping your spirit strong in these very challenging times?
I think to get over, I am seeing people in person that we care, have a lot of care for each other, and getting back into art and my art practice in some ways, reading a little bit more.
Great. Yeah. And I participated in a ride in memory of Alex Pretty, the Minneapolis intensive care nurse who was murdered by ICE agents. There was a ride, very spirited, largely attended. It wound up at the ICE facility, where unfortunately we were met with rubber bullets and tear gas. But aside from that, it was a very inspiring and strengthening day. So I'll say goodbye to you for now, and we'll connect again at the half-hour mark. Before we get to our first guest, Sarah Swallow, just a few quick news items. The first one is about Alex Pretty, the Minneapolis nurse I mentioned, who was also a cyclist. And as BikeRetailer.com and Cycling Weekly reported, he was a familiar presence at the city's bikes events and a customer at the Angry Catfish Bike Shop. He was one of us. He participated in the same events that I went to. It definitely hits home, said Jeff Frain, the founder of Wild Bikes, a custom frame brand. And in response, many businesses went on strike and came up with really strong statements of support for Alex and his families. Salsa Cycle wrote, "Our neighbors are being unlawfully detained, harassed, and murdered at the hands of the federal immigration enforcement agents. Now is the time to speak up and stand up." And these rides were held across the country in honor of Alex Pretty. In Portland, Oregon, over 1,000 riders paid their respect, resolved that the murder will not become just one more state statistic, remembered only until the next one. They rode across town and remembered Alex. Rest in peace, Alex Pretty, and may your life and death spur us all to do all we can to triumph over a lawless regime. And in a little more cheerful note here, MSN reports that some Amish communities are adopting e-bikes instead of horses. The Amish are well known for maintaining traditional ways and avoiding many modern technologies, but individual Amish communities are allowed to set their own rules, and some of the more progressive ones have recently expanded their allowance of bikes to include e-bikes, seeing them not as a technological disruption, but as a service to them. David Klein, the bishop of an old order church near Mount Hope, Ohio, explained that the Amish are not opposed to technology, but the destructive effects they believe it would have on their communities, as with cars. Abe Troyer, an Amish who works at Klein Lumber, said that his e-bike gives him more time to be with his family because the commute is 45 minutes shorter. It's basically 10 miles a day, but I do a lot more than just work. I go different places at different times. So in the last year and a half, I put 3,400 miles on my bike. So those are some quick news items. And I just want to mention quickly that last month, our guest, one of our guests was Marley Blonsky of the organization All Bodies and Bikes, and the organization is having a benefit screening of the film We Are Cyclists that will be shown on Thursday, February 12th at the Kiln. So for more information about this film, check their website. And now, without further ado, I'd like to introduce our first guest, who is Sarah Swallow. Definitely an adventure cyclist, if there ever was one. Looking at her website, I was amazed at her many rides, the effort she put in, the heart, and also creating community. She is one of the first people, if not the first one, to ride on the Golden Gravel Trail, a new 3,700-mile gravel route from the Oregon coast to the Mississippi River. And over the past 10 years, she rode across six continents and explored more than 21 countries by bikepacking tens of thousands of miles, completing some of the most grueling and rewarding cycling challenges imaginable. She has also created and led rides, and her website has wonderful information and articles about her experiences. So good day, Sarah Swallow, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Alon. Thank you. It's a privilege to be here. Thank you for having me.
The privilege is ours. And where does this find you?
I'm in Tucson, Arizona.
Ah, okay. And where's your home base? You travel so much, but is there a place you call home?
Yes, I'm privileged to be able to call Tucson and Durango, Colorado home. So split time between both places.
All right. So we'll start. I like to start with a simple question about some of your early bicycle memories. When did you start riding a bike?
I probably started riding my bike when I was, around 6 years old. But it was just in a cul-de-sac in a suburban neighborhood. And, early memories were riding along with my dad on a bike trail in Southern California to a donut shop, stuff like that. But really, the formative experience was when I was around 12 years old and I got a job, my first job at a bike rental in Loveland, Ohio, along a rail trail, bike trail that now is probably over 100 miles long. But so I started working with bikes before I considered myself a cyclist.
Hmm. And how did you make that transition from, cycling to work or for recreation to becoming an adventure cyclist, a professional cyclist? Was it a decision of one moment or gradual process?
Yeah, it was mostly a gradual process. I had worked with bikes for quite a while, and then when I graduated from high school, I had always played sports in high school. I played field hockey, and when I had graduated from high school, I was looking for something to do that didn't involve running, because I've never been a big fan of running. And my dad had introduced me to road cycling, because that was something he had picked up after destroying his knees from running so many street marathons. And just that feeling of the freedom and the ability to get to places that I had never experienced, especially in Southwest Ohio, really kind of opened up the world of early adventure cycling for me. And, then getting my first map and kind of exploring places in Southwest Ohio, a place that I had always kind of resisted, having spent my early childhood in Southern California, the bicycle kind of exposed me to kind of the beauty of that place and a greater appreciation for it.
And what was the first really long trip you took?
Yeah, so probably like the first really long trip I had taken was this ride across the country on the Transamerica Trail, which was it's easily confused with the Adventure Cycling Transamerica Trail that takes Route 76 across the U.S. But this was a dual sport motorcycle route that spanned, you know, from the Outer Banks of North Carolina to Port Orford, Oregon, and it was 5,000 miles. And, you know, as a bike shop owner at the time, I had been working full time in shops for, you know, almost 10 years at that point. And I was ready to, you know, kind of experience what, you know, living on the bike felt like. And so it was really only my, you know, fifth or sixth bike tour, and first one over 7 days long. And yeah, that was definitely the longest.
And you have written about what you called emotional and mental aspects of traveling by bike. How do you prepare for such a long ride? I mean, what do you do nutritionally, emotionally, mentally? What's involved in preparing for such a journey?
Yeah, so I think it really depends on the trip itself. If it's a trip that I'm trying to accomplish a lot of miles in a short period of time, the preparation for that trip, it would be different than a trip where I'm going to spend, you know, 5 to 6 weeks riding maybe only 1,200 miles, but I'm fully immersing myself in the place. So, you know, for instance, with the trip to, you know, a longer trip with shorter miles where I'm immersing myself, you know, there's a lot more research and education beforehand to kind of understand the place that I'm going to, researching my route and preparing my equipment more so than necessarily my fitness. Of course, my fitness and strength is really important, and sometimes when you're traveling, most of the time when you're traveling, it's harder to kind of meet your nutritional needs as you would living at home. So I definitely kind of fuel up in preparation for kind of the deficit that I will experience. But, you know, if I'm preparing for something where I'm trying to ride many miles in a short period of time, then there's a bit more strength training involved, and, you know, longer miles and more kind of there, with all of it, there's always this, you know, looking at my values, looking at where the trip is aligned and kind of, you know, making sure I'm aligned with what I'm doing.
You are listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show. All our shows are available on bikeshow.portlandtransport.com and are carried by fellow community radio stations in the U.S. And we're speaking now with professional and adventure cyclist Sarah Swallow, who is truly a trailblazer in adventure cycling. One of the interesting articles on your website was titled Quitting, A Cyclist's Guide to Graceful Exits. First of all, what is a graceful exit? And were there times that you felt that, you know, what are you doing on this trail? You'd rather be at home sleeping in your bed?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, a graceful exit, you know, is, you know, leaving something that you know, you set out to do. And I think that, especially with adventure cycling, I'm really focused on the non-competitive side of it. So unless you are doing a competition, an event where it requires you to ride every single mile or, you know, do a certain thing in a certain time, then quitting needs to be redefined, because, you know, if you can bring in more flexibility and the ability to pivot and to have that, you know, flexibility within yourself and how you move through the route and stay present with yourself, you're much more guaranteed to stick with what you are doing and have a more fulfilling experience than saying, oh, hey, I, you know, I'm having a really hard time and I can't afford to take any more days off, and so I might as well just quit this whole thing and go home, you know? It's like, no, actually, I do have some extra time. I can take a few days off. Or if I'm not enjoying it, I can take a bus or a train, you know, a little further down the route, you know, get a change of scenery and continue on and see how it feels from there. So I'm all about kind of having flexibility and pivoting when needed so that you don't have to just go home and you know, lay in your bed. But I've certainly had my moments where that was the best decision for me at the time. And I would say in most of those cases, it was because I was doing something that was not aligned with my values. So I was trying to do something like a race or a competition, or I was trying to find community in a place that wasn't creating community, and realizing that on the ride and realizing, you know, actually this is actually going to drain me more than it's going to fuel me. And this is a good time to kind of end this ride and regroup and save this energy for something more meaningful.
So being kind to yourself, knowing your limits, seem valuable lessons for any task in life. You've also recently rode on the Golden Gravel Trail. Can you tell us about how that trail came to be and what was it like riding on it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Golden Gravel Trail is actually a new cross-country route that is designed by Adventure Cycling Association. So as you mentioned before, it's a 3,700-mile dirt road route. It spans from the Mississippi River to the coast of Oregon, and it travels through 8 states. So it goes through Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, Idaho, and Oregon. And the route was inspired by that dual sport motorcycle route that I had ridden in 2015, and I had provided a lot of feedback on, because it wasn't necessarily suitable for bikes, considering it was designed for dual sport motorcycles. And so Adventure Cycling Association had taken my feedback from my ride in 2015 and kind of redesigned a route, you know, inspired by the TAT. And yeah, so they asked me, as someone who rode the TAT and provided that feedback, to test the Golden Gravel Trail, promote it, and provide feedback ahead of its official launch in March of this year. And yeah, so I did that ride. I started you know, at the end of August and finished early October. I did I rode from Port Orford, Oregon, and I rode essentially back home to Durango, Colorado. So I did the western portion of the route, which is all new compared to the TAT route that I rode in 2015. And yeah, it was primarily a solo journey, which you know, navigating the challenges of you know, navigating a new route as a solo woman was definitely you know, I had some anxiety with that, and just not knowing how long certain sections would take to get between resupplies, and not knowing where the water sources are. These are all things that kind of come with the terrain of riding a route that has no route guide or published. But when it does get published, you know, that all that information is provided to the rider. But there's the key part of, you know, testing these routes and figuring out where these things are and how long the route takes and how it feels, how it flows. And that's kind of what I was doing over that month.
And this route, looking at it on the map, it definitely goes through some very diverse landscapes. It goes in the mountains, and it's quite an achievement creating it. One of the things that really spoke to me on your website was when you said that for you, and I quote, "The bicycle is far more than a mode of transportation. It's a tool for well-being, community connection, and deepening my relationship with the natural landscape." Can you elaborate a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I don't just use the bicycle for fitness or transportation. I use it consciously to connect with myself in a physical way, which is a form of meditation for me. It's also one of my social outlets. It's a great way for me to connect with my family and my friends and my community. And then when I ride, I just become more immersed in the landscapes I'm riding through, which leads for me to more curiosity and ultimately research and understanding of the place. And finally, I just add that it broadens my global perspective in terms of traveling outside of my bubble, outside of my comfort zone. And we all have biases that are informed by all sorts of things, but I feel like traveling by bike to a place that's new and that's different or far away or outside of my bubble, outside of my state or my country, it expands my perspective and understanding of the people and the cultures from those places.
And you've also written about an essay called Bikepacking for Couples, Part 2, Strategies for Experiencing Joy and Managing Conflict. Briefly, what are the challenges of riding with a partner or a mate? And does it lead to divorce or to breakup of relationship or actually strengthen it?
I think it could do both things. And I think whatever is occurring in the relationship will be amplified on a bicycle adventure together. In one part, it can amplify conflicts and it can make things feel a bit more intense. But on the other hand, you can share really rewarding and fun and meaningful experiences together. So it can really bring people together, and it can also bring people, divide people apart. So I believe, like, you know, the key is communication and consciously going into it with a good intention and making sure that it's a balanced reciprocity in terms of what each person is contributing and getting out of the experience, whether it's, you know, one person is navigating and the other person is setting up camp or cooking the food. So it's just managing, you know, the normal stuff that you would navigate back at home. I just, you know, recommend that, you know, there's sometimes like an imbalance of skill or speed or experience, and it's always just good to kind of load the more experienced or quicker rider with more stuff to unburden the person that's maybe newer to the experience. And then to try to, you know, be okay with riding separate paces, but regrouping frequently, because and that way I think a lot of people struggle. They're like, well, I gotta ride really, really slow, or I gotta ride really, really fast to keep up. But it doesn't have to be that way. You can ride your own ride and have your own experience and kind of come together and regroup and share those regroup experiences and also the camping.
And in the essay, I like that there were actually practical suggestions, very, very wise one, in my opinion. Our time is almost up, so I just want to ask you two last questions. One is about a group you co-founded, Radical Adventure Riders. What is this group about?
Yeah, so I co-founded Radical Adventure Riders with six other folks, many who are in Portland still. We founded it in 2017. It's a group to create space for gender inclusivity and racial equity in cycling. It's evolved a lot over the years, and I'm no longer involved with the organization, but as where we started it was just creating space for people that share common experiences in cycling to go bikepacking, or to, you know, we hosted multiple summits. One was just outside of Portland, and, you know, educational experiences to come together to talk about our experience. And, you know, in 2017 and 2018, for a lot of us, none of these kinds of groups existed. And so, yeah, it's been inspiring to see kind of how it's grown and developed over the years. You know, in COVID, we kind of, the group kind of migrated more to an online community and spread out across chapters across the U.S. So there's regional chapters now where people can find a RAR group and you know, have community in that, with that space.
And for, and for those interested, find out more about Radical Adventure Riders, they could look at your website.
And radicaladventureriders.com as well.
Okay, and finally, what's next for you? Where will we might find you in 10, 20 years? What's the next adventure?
Oh, gosh, good question. You know, I'm heavily invested in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. Right now, I see that work continuing through my event called Ruta del Jefe. And it's a four-day community-centered festival rooted in adventure, connection, education, and advocacy. And, you know, we kind of, instead of competition, we build community and create for space for cultural change, environmental awareness, and social impact. So there's meals, there's talks from local conservation, humanitarian, nonprofits, educational workshops, a community fundraiser, and a bunch of adventure rides. So just kind of trying to create more spaces like Ruta del Jefe and continue Ruta del Jefe and kind of bring people together with more community rather than competition and more more connection to the place so that we can you know, give back rather than extract.
Amen, amen, amen. we have been speaking with professional cyclist and trailblazer and adventure cycling Sarah Swallow. Thank you so much for being on the show and all the good work you do in this world, and all the best in whatever next adventure awaits.
Thank you so much, Alan.
Yeah, take care. You're listening to the KBO Radio Bike Show, broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming on KBO.FM. And all shows going back to 2001 are archived on bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. We will now take a short musical break, and when we return, Nedra will speak with Sarah Dubai Fiorito, who's the Transportation and Mobility Coordinator for the City of Evanston, Illinois.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, 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 oh. Wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land.
I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. The world won't get no better if we just let it be.
No, 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 no.
We gotta change it now, just you and me. Change it, yeah, just you and me. Change it, yeah,
change it.
Can't do it alone,
can't do it alone.
Need some help, y'all, y'all. Can't do it alone,
can't do it alone.
Yeah, yeah. Need a little help, y'all.
Yes, I do.
Need a little help.
Say it, boy.
Need some help, y'all. Change the world what it used to be. Can't do it alone.
Can't do it alone.
Need some help, yeah.
Need some help, yeah.
Welcome back to KBOO Bike Radio Show. Wake up, everybody. What a great way to start the second half. You just listened to Alon interview Sarah Swallow, a trailblazer, adventure cyclist, and conscious traveler. Up next, we will have Sarah Dubu-Fiorito join us. Sarah has over a decade of transportation work, built a bicycle mechanics based youth and workforce program. She's led campaigns for universal cycling and initiated intergovernmental collaborations and coalitions for better street design and transit, and currently works for as a transportation coordinator and policy programs and partnership in our hometown of Evanston, Illinois. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hello. Good afternoon, Nedra.
Good afternoon. It is really nice to have you here. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. Yeah. The day is off to a good start, getting lots of stuff done. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, wonderful. On KBOO, we like to start, on the bike show, we like to get to know you a little bit, you know, what motivates you, what's your passion, you know, what thing you're building, but also, like, who you are as a person and how you came to bicycling. What are some of your early memories around biking? How old were you, your first bike, any great trip?
Yeah. Thank you for asking. I remember our dad, along with our neighbor's dad, our neighbor was learning around the same time, taught my sister and I how to ride a two-wheel bike. And I remember when I was younger, our family used to go on bike rides. Like, a thing that we did was go on bike rides to an ice cream store in Evanston called, now it's actually called Hardigan's, but at the time it was Baskin Robbins, and then they eventually made it independent. So that was like, yeah, bicycling was a very like happy thing. It was kind of like a thing that you do to go to like an exciting, fun, nice local place. So I would say definitely have like positive early associations with riding.
Mm-hmm. As a young person, you know, getting on the bike with your family, was that a motivator, or was there like any fear factor because it was kind of a big event, or did that make it an easier way to start to start riding?
So I will say, you know, when we were kids riding with the family, we always, I remember, like, our mom would always ride with us on the sidewalk, and our dad would always ride in the street next to us. And it actually took me, our mom had, like, a very strict helmet rule. Like, if you were riding a bike, you had to wear a helmet. And I remember growing up in the 90s feeling like helmets were very embarrassing and uncool. So I think for me as a really young person, especially later on into my youth when it came to riding to high school, I actually remember really wanting to ride to school and actually being very interested in that and interested in having the autonomy that comes with riding a bicycle. But because of my, I don't know if I'll say vanity or maybe just like, you know, fear of being different, fear of being dorky, I didn't want to ride with a helmet. And because I also, I think, probably was scared and maybe felt it was dangerous to ride without a helmet, I actually forewent bicycling for like a lot of transportation trips that I would have liked to have used it for when I was in high school. It was more of like an every now and then thing. And it wasn't until I started actually riding without a helmet for some period that I started like using my bike to ride to like work in the summer and things like that. And I did find that very empowering.
Hmm. You jumped right into the discussion on helmet or no helmet. Where are you with the helmet these days?
So what I'll say first and foremost is that, when I'm teaching, especially any programs that I've run with young people, definitely helmet. And I definitely, you know, helmets definitely help protect people's heads. If, you know, I encourage people to wear helmets if they want. I know a lot of cycling and other organizations feel like prioritizing helmet use is putting the burden of an unsafe road network onto individual cyclists, when really the issue is we need to be separating people from cars. And obviously, we know that, you know, places where cycling is very popular, you know, like Northern Europe and stuff like that, people aren't using it. I think people, adults, and people, it makes sense to have a choice. And ultimately, I think a lot of the infrastructure improvements that are needed in the United States are really where we should be focusing our attention when it comes to safety, first and foremost.
Yeah, appreciate your comment, because it covers a lot of the bases and gets to the heart of the matter. Is infrastructure and design. It's not just what you have on your head, because many things can get hurt when you fall off a bike or you're involved in a crash. You know, reading through your LinkedIn and just kind of even what I've learned about you is that, I mean, you have deep education, you know, within multimodal transportation, but you say yourself that it was climate change that really sparked for you this interest in climate change and the fact that we're sprawling, like every city, you know, everything is a sprawl, grew concern in you. Can you speak more to that and how that motivated you to get more involved in transportation and city design?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So when I was really, a lot of my interest in transportation and urban planning started when I was in my undergraduate degree at school. My undergraduate degree is like a business program, and my minor was in economics. And I took my first environmental economics classes, kind of at a time where I was just learning a little bit more about how systems work, and thinking a little bit more critically about how things work in the world, and basically got exposed to certain policies related to, you know, things like carbon taxes and things that, according to economics principles, you know, you should be able to price things accordingly and then reduce, you know, for example, the amount of carbon that's being emitted by polluters in the economy. And I was learning about these things, and, you know, I remember asking a professor, well, if we have all these solutions and we know how to price carbon at the exact rate that it would be, you know, the optimal rate, then why aren't we doing this? Why is climate change an issue? And I just remember him kind of saying that the issue was really political will, and that a lot of, you know, that basically things weren't being done, things weren't being fixed, that nobody was really dealing with these problems that are so huge, and that a lot of effective solutions are actually just not being implemented for a lot of different things, including for climate change. And I honestly just felt very concerned. Like, you know, before that, I had felt like, wow, things are, you know, somebody's taking care of this stuff. And I think that was like this, my kind of introduction to thinking about systems and being like, wow, like things are really not okay. Obviously, as I've grown older, my analysis has deepened, and I see the many, many ways that a lot of things need change that have, you know, a lot of in a lot of other areas. But basically, for me, I got very excited about transportation and urban planning because I saw it as these very real ways to change things. And I saw from research that I did on urban sprawl containment that basically there are very concrete things that cities can do to encourage people to use public transportation, to have like a built form that, you know, supports walking and bicycling and public transit use. And I thought that was very inspiring. And since that time, I've just been interested in this stuff.
Yeah, very cool. For a station announcement, you are listening to KBOO Radio Bike Show. All shows are available on www.bikeshowportlandtransport.com and are carried by fellow community radio stations in the U.S., including every other Sunday at noon on KORC in Corvallis. and streaming worldwide at korcfm.com. My name is Nedra Deadweiler, and our guest is Sarah Duby Fiorito, transportation practitioner, community builder, and advocate. So on what you were just saying, Sarah, you know, it's really political will. And I must say that you talk about all of this, these systems, and like really walking things in a very approachable way. So, which I would say, you know, I would attribute it to your work, your community work, your grassroots work. Can you share some about like the work you've done in the community and what you've learned from that practice?
Yeah. So my, you know, I've really come of age as a young adult in a lot of ways, the cycling community, especially in the community bike shop world, but also just in the broader cycling community in Vancouver, where I lived for 8 years, when I was in my 20s. And, I really got started in Vancouver because I had started riding my bike through the winter there when I first moved there. And I think it was the end of 2012 when I moved there after I graduated from school. And ultimately I just got very excited about cycling. Like something really clicked for me. It was just like, I loved the efficiency of it. I think I felt very excited to finally be doing it in a way that I hadn't been brave enough to do when I was a teen. And yeah, I just loved so much about it. Just made a lot of sense to me. And so I started pretty early on in becoming a year-round bike commuter there. I started, you know, because bikes obviously need maintenance. And so I ended up finding my way into community bike shops in Vancouver, which Vancouver has one of the oldest formal community bike shops, or some consider it the oldest formal community bike shop, nonprofit shop in North America. I'll let others argue about whether that's true, but basically I ended up getting very involved in a budding bike shop there at the time called Kickstand Community Bike Shop, which was a volunteer run space. And over the years, between volunteering at Kickstand, you know, being part of forming the first board there, being part of, you know, initiating its first nonprofit status, and we're learning a lot from some of my, you know, mentors in that community who had kind of been the initial founders. You know, that space, and then later also paid work that I did in another community bike shop called Our Community Bikes, and their nonprofit called Pedal Foundation. I ended up doing both a lot of unpaid work as a volunteer at first, and then eventually, you know, teaching after school programs and summer camps centered around safe riding skills and bike skills to young kids. Eventually during that period, what started as, you know, unpaid community organizing work around getting a street organizing for support of a street redesign in the community, that ended up turning later on, especially because of a lot of the business owner relationships that I built in there, that ended up later turning into paid campaign work with the British Columbia Cycling Coalition, and then also another paid campaign with a coalition called Bike Right, which was for universal cycling education across the province. So basically, you know, the community work that I've done has really been a mixture of direct service, so teaching a lot of bike mechanics in DIY spaces, teaching formal programs like after school youth programs, and also a lot of, you know, a mixture of policy work in there, and community organizing. So it's been a lot. I've learned really a lot in this work, honestly.
Yeah, remarkable. It sounds like, I mean, you kind of got the best place to be, like a very strong bike city. So you got a strong infrastructure network, and then you got a city with a strong bike culture. Like, sounds like that really impacted you, not only grew your knowledge and your love for the transportation or sport. You know, people look at bicycling so many ways, but it gave you a perspective on being able to, like, look future-oriented. What are some things that you are seeing that you really like that's happening as you look across the bike stratosphere, or what are some things you're seeing for the future that you think, like, you know, from your lived experience, your professional experience, that, you know, that's really a good direction?
Yeah, I think, so one thing that is definitely exciting to me is just talking to a lot of young people, you know, especially, like, part of what I do as part of my job, and also just part of what I like to do in general, just as a person living in, you know, in a city. You know, when I talk to teenagers, whether it's at Evanston Township High School or whether it's just people out and about the world at a community event or wherever it is, or, you know, a friend's kid or whoever, I feel inspired to hear a lot of youth actually be very cosmopolitan in their transportation preferences. I hear a lot of youth who are really enjoy the autonomy of taking public transit, and of riding a bicycle. And, you know, I know that there's, you know, different stats and stuff that folks are taking a look at, like at maybe AAA was one of the groups that put out some studies, I can't remember, about, actually probably not them, but about, you know, declining driver's license rates amongst teens now compared to, for example, when I was a teen. And I think just transportation trends in general are changing. And I think that's really exciting. I think, you know, people want to have more options and are less, maybe some people, not all, depends where people live, but maybe people in urban areas, I do feel like there is a culture shift, at least, where as before there was probably a time where certain people felt like, oh, if you can afford a car, you know, that's kind of the way to go. And I think, you know, more people are seeing the benefits of not always using a car, even if they have one, and I think that's really great.
Yeah, it reduces the need for sprawl too. Kind of your, yeah, one of your earlier, you know, gave me concern about, like, how cities are designed. We met at we met around bicycling education, and you've done work in universal bike education for young people. Speaking of young people, what is that, and why is universal cycling education important, and when should it begin?
Yeah, so this is a topic that I think is very inspiring, and there's some good foundations being built by groups like Ride Illinois and Active Transportation Alliance. And I've heard that actually as of this week, I know the Secretary of State in Illinois is making some cool moves. But generally, so universal cycling education, first of all, I'm going to credit the Bike Right Coalition and a lot of really amazing, imaginative people working in the British Columbian context. Which is also on unceded Coast Salish territory, which is something I also learned about there that really shaped my perspective on the world. And basically, the idea is that we need to be teaching young people as vulnerable road users mobility education in schools. The idea is really, Right now, if you get a driver's license, that's kind of when you learn formally road safety skills in a very comprehensive way. Today, a lot of people who aren't getting their driver's license don't necessarily ever get real comprehensive training on how to be a safe road user. And I think, you know, basically the idea behind universal cycling education system or mobility education that also encompasses walking, which is really what I believe it should, along with potentially covering other types of vehicles that are becoming more popular, whether it's e-bikes or e-scooters, Basically, the idea is, hey, this is a life skill. This is safety oriented. These are also foundational skills, not only that kids need to keep themselves safe, but also that kids need to travel as independent, autonomous people in their communities. These can be skills that they use to get to school, to get to their friends' houses, to not need to be chauffeured by adults in their lives. And, you know, this is just a life skill that kids need to learn. And so the idea in when I was working on it in BC, and also some of the conversations now in this, in the Chicago area or the Illinois area, is really around, this is a life skill. It's also health related because it gets people thinking about an active lifestyle, and it should be taught in PE class because that's where we're teaching this stuff. Nedra? Hello?
Yeah, Nedra?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I muted myself. Well, it's the last, we're in our last minute. I want to say thank you so much, Sarah, for being here and sharing more about your policy work and your education work and the work and how you see communities and cycling. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Cycle. Can you hear me? Hello? Hello, hello?
Yes.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that. You're listening to KBOO Bike Radio Show, broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon. Our guests have been Sarah Swallow and Sarah Doobie Fiorito.
Portland. Yep. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7.